Husker Doc Talk Podcast, presented by the Remington Trophy, 2017, Episode 19. The smoke is cleared, and now, as Tom Petty once said, and I should say the late Tom Petty, the waiting is the hardest part. The wait for Bill Moose, the wait for current and returning players, the wait for fans, the wait for Scott Frost to officially say yes and accept the job. I'm Travis Justice, joined once again by the smartest Husker ever, academic All-American, Big 8 Athlete of the Year, Dr. Rob Zadiska. What's up?
How are you doing tonight?
I couldn't be better. I got to ask you this. How many times in the last week since we recorded our last podcast has somebody come up and said, hey, Doc, what do you think about Scott Frost?
Oh, my God. I'm so ready to put a bullet through my freaking head. I can't go anywhere without hearing it. It's just nonstop.
Well, at least it's a good thing that you are still recognized as a Husker and people still know you do this podcast and they want to know your opinion.
I swear to God, we went off TV and went to a podcast and I get recognized more often now.
I just to let you know, it's because it's one of the most listened to Husker podcasts there is out there.
It's a pretty good podcast.
You know, in the last 4 years, like 1.4 million downloads.
That's a lot of listens.
That's a lot of listens. To two, you know, guys who just like to drink beer and do this thing just during the season. It's not like we do this year round. It's just
a couple of just two dudes, a couple of good looking dudes. I'm trying to channel my inner Stewie from Family Guy here.
You know, we of course we knew after Iowa drilled Nebraska. I mean, beat Nebraska like a drum.
I was thinking after the Northwestern game.
Well, let me relish in the victory that the Hawkeyes had. Would you just for a little bit? Let me relish into that. But you knew it was coming. I was there when Frank Solich got fired. I was there when Bill Callahan got fired. I was there when Bo Pelini got fired. And this was like the most graceful firing I've ever seen in my life.
This was the nicest firing I've ever seen. I guarantee you he was like consoling Bill Moose.
It was weird, wasn't it? I mean, it was cool, but it was weird.
It was, I don't know if I thought it was weird. I would like to think that if and or when I ever get fired, I'm going to have the grace to go out in the same way. I mean, that's about the best way to phrase it.
Can I say something? You're a doctor. You're a part owner in your anesthesiology group. You're not going to get fired.
I could screw something up. You don't know that.
That's true. That insurance is pretty expensive.
It is.
And you have the God complex. You have people's lives in your hands every single day.
You said I got a God complex?
Yes, you do.
Oh, please.
You don't have a God complex? Isn't that why you became a doctor?
I just like sticking needles in people and giving them drugs.
You know, but it almost it came to, you know, the way Mike Riley got up there and thanked everybody. It was classy, and it really exemplified what it was all about for the last 3 years. But it was almost like, God, you're too nice. And what I mean by that, you're almost too nice to have that killer instinct to be a great football coach.
Well, and we had a question that, you know, I kind of had to think about it a little bit on Twitter. I think it was Dave who asked it on Twitter. Would you rather have a nice coach or would you rather have a winning coach? Now, he didn't say asshole coach. He said winning coach. Now, I assume kind of the deeper part of the question is would you rather have a winning coach who's not a nice person? It's kind of a hard question to answer because in my experience, I would say off the top of my head, I'll take the winning coach. Now, the guys I played for at Nebraska, was Tom Osborne a nice guy? Yeah, but at the same time, it was a demanding thing to be a player for Tom Osborne. It's not like it was this carefree, stress-free existence. It was incredibly demanding because you had this level of expectation to live up to, and a lot of it started with his expectations. The guy had just unbelievably high standards. Now, he was an outstanding coach, and the guy was an insanely good human being. And I think he genuinely tried to do the right thing. But, I mean, that level of demand gives a guy like Tom Osborne, kind of gives him a bit of an edge that I don't think a lot of people really recognize.
And
those expectations. And you look at the rest of Osborne's coaching staff. I mean, you had guys like Ron Brown who, the only way I can phrase it, very godly man. And he lived that on, I mean, he kind of, I mean, that, talk about having your emotions on your sleeves. I mean, Brown lived that day in and day out. But, I mean, if you ever saw Ron Brown at practice, again, incredibly demanding. The wide receivers and tight ends might have been the hardest working group of players on that team. Charlie McBride, I mean, the guy was hellfire as a coach. Tenneper and Dan Young, they weren't afraid to chew you out. I mean, it's not like these were – it's not like it was rainbows and unicorns down there. I don't know if nice is not a good word for those guys, Tom Osborne included.
You know, the word
they were good people.
The word football and nice should never go together, should it?
Well, it's kind of like the whole George Carlin baseball and football comedy routine. Football's played on the gridiron. Baseball's played on a field.
There's some truth to it, though.
It is. It's, but yeah, Tom. I wouldn't call Tom Osborne a nice coach. He was a great coach, and he was an exceedingly good person. But not nice. I don't know if I'd call him nice. I don't know if I'd call any of those assistant coaches nice. Are those the guys I would want as my coaches? If somebody said, hey, Rob, you're going to go to this weird – if you're going to go die and go to this weird purgatorial afterlife where you play football for Nebraska for all eternity, those are the coaches I'd pick to coach me. But I wouldn't call them nice. Now, I've played for coaches that were nice before. I've played for coaches that were complete assholes. If you're winning, I mean, that whole line about winning cures everything. If you're winning, I'll take the guy who's not a nice coach if we're winning.
You know, the way things have unfolded over since the weekend with Brett Bielema getting fired, Todd Graham getting fired at Arizona State, Mullen getting the job at Florida. It's really starting to fall in place. And the thing that happened at Tennessee is still the most bizarre thing I've ever seen ever. Greg Schiano got screwed. I don't care how you feel about it.
I think that was
a fan base who did not want Greg Schiano.
That was a highly orchestrated, well-planned out effort on social media. I mean, you saw that's one of the few times I've actually seen a fan base or a group of fans rise up and utilize social media
to spread fake news.
To kind of spin a situation, which I mean, the whole Sandusky thing at Penn State, at this point, I'll believe freaking anything, truth be told, which is why that worked. I mean, is there a sliver of doubt? Yeah, there is. Maybe Shiana did know something. I don't know. Crap, Paterno knew. Now, there's evidence Paterno knew stuff going back to, what, the 70s or 80s? I mean, it's insane. Anyway.
Which wouldn't surprise me, but still.
Anyway, my point is yeah, that might have been the most bizarre thing I've ever seen.
So, I mean, the only thing that's going to happen to Scott Frost now, and with Scott saying in his press conference, listen, if Nebraska wasn't interested in me, I'd be disappointed. The way Bill Moos has just gushed over Scott Frost leading up to the firing of Mike Riley, there's only one of two things that's going to happen.
Psychologically, in my mind, that was him saying he's taking the job.
Exactly. So he either stays at Central Florida, which isn't going to happen because there's no way they can match the money, or he comes to Nebraska.
No, in one of the, you know, in I think it was the same interview where he stated the whole, if they weren't interested, I'd be disappointed. He made a really good quote, and I had a conversation with a buddy of mine about, like, in regards to Scott Frost, how do you keep a straight face with your players? How do you maintain trust with your own players? And how do you maintain a sense of, going forward, I'm a guy who can tell my players, no, I'm your coach, and then potentially a week or two later, he's going to leave and take the job at Nebraska. And I remember having the conversation with a couple of my friends about how, you know, you don't tell them you're taking the job, but you tell them, listen, there's always the potential that I could leave. I may not be here forever. And we'll address that after the season's over. But for now, I am your coach. But one of the points that went through my head then was, is you remove yourself from the equation. You talk about how the success is due to the system that's in place. You talk about how the success is due to the players themselves and the strides they've made, and how it's not dependent upon the coach. And Scott did that in that. I mean, it almost scared me listening to it. I was like, oh, my God, he's explaining how he's going to exit this job at Central Florida. He was explaining how they've got the system in place. They've got the administration in place. They've got the players. They've got the talent to go undefeated, and it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with him as a coach. And that's, in my mind, that's an exit interview. I could be wrong. I don't think I am, though.
No, and what you're saying, he's not taking the credit. He's saying everybody involved here has made this what it is in a short amount of time. You can still succeed without me.
Exactly.
And that's kind of what I got out of that, too. Hey, we are close to finding out who this year's Remington Trophy winner is. You can meet this year's winner at the Remington Trophy presentation January 13th, 2018 at the Rococo Theater in Lincoln. This year's featured speaker... I can't tell you that. I know who it's going to be. I know.
Oh, you got it. You haven't even told me.
I know, and I was waiting for word for Dave to give me the confirmation, but I can't make the announcement yet. But I can tell you, it's going to be very well worth it. It's going to be somebody you know, somebody who's pretty popular, and somebody who played the game at the highest level.
The featured speakers the last few years have been gold.
This year's Ford Legends Award winner is Joseph Montgomery. He's a 1974 graduate of William & Mary. For ticket information and table information, go to RemingtonTrophy.com. And, of course, Remington Trophy has always been the presenting sponsor of this, the Husker Doc Talk podcast.
That means that we are drinking a beer!
The Infusion Brewing Company is the official beer provider of the Husker Doc Talk podcast. Tonight, we are drinking the Pistachio Porter. This beer is for the winter months, folks. Brewed with English malts and lots of cocoa powder. The warmer the beer gets, the more the chocolate comes out. It's 6.8% alcohol by volume, 33 IBU. Rob, this is
alcoholic.
This is alcoholic
hot chocolate.
But what I can say is it's interesting because I took it right out of the fridge. We got a full 64-ounce growler, took it out of the fridge. It's very cold and it's sweet. But have you noticed the warmer it gets, the sweetness goes down?
You kind of commented on that because I took a sip of it when we first took it out, and I was just like, I don't know if I like this. I'm not a fan of the really heavy. Caramely sweet porters.
Yeah.
And if when this is cold, you have that first sip, that's the first thing that hits you. It's like, hey, I'm drinking alcoholic Aunt Jemima right here.
Alcoholic Aunt Jemima.
I'm just saying it's alcoholic Aunt Jemima. And I love Aunt Jemima. But this is alcoholic Aunt Jemima.
So this is, you know, you can almost pour this right out of the fridge on like French toast, pancakes.
Ooh, if you could do like a pistachio porter reduction, it'd be like great for like a brunch.
But I can tell you, as it starts to warm up, and this is what I would do. I would get it right out of the keg. I would let it, when you're at the Infusion Brewing Company, I'd just let it sit there for maybe 5-10 minutes. Just talk to your buddies.
This thing does need to sit.
And yes.
I poured a pretty big glass.
Yes, you did.
It's about half full. I always pour a big glass. It's about half gone now. The second half, way better. It's a little more complex. That sweetness starts going away. You get a little bit more of kind of that bitter bite.
And the chocolate comes out a little bit more.
It does. It's not... do you know what it's like? If you're one of those perp people who's not a big fan of, say, Joe Bob Hershey's milk chocolate because it's too sweet and plain, but you like a really good, almost bitter dark chocolate, this is the dark chocolate of beers. If beer was chocolate, this would be like the bitter dark chocolate.
There you go. That's the explanation according to the mad scientist. And he knows his science. He knows his chemicals. He knows his bitters and his sours and his alkalines.
I know my beer.
You do know your beer.
I like beer.
Most importantly, you know your beer. And we got lots of great beer at the Infusion Brewing Company. Two locations in the Omaha area. For more information, go to infusionbrewing.com. You know, I do know this. I want to do a podcast recording live at Infusion.
We do need to do that.
Do you think you could recruit? We can't. I don't have any money to pay them, but do you think you could recruit some some of your buddies to come up? Maybe some guys on your little text chain there?
Oh, God, they'd be there in an instant.
Would they?
Well, no. Which text chain?
The player one.
That one I don't know about. Dude, half those guys don't live in Omaha.
Yeah, it's true. But I think either the one right after when Scott gets hired.
I can try. I will try.
We'll try to just get everybody to sit at a table, get a bunch of people up in Infusion and Benson. We'll record a podcast, put a speaker out. We'll have people ask questions. You can sign autographs, do whatever you need to do.
I don't know if people want my autograph.
People want your autograph.
They want to know what I think about Scott Frost, apparently. Because I get asked that like 19 times a freaking day.
Hey, the football season is over, but there are lots of great sporting events, concerts, and more to go to. Tickets make great stocking stuffers during the holiday season. For the best seats to the biggest events, go to Ticket Express. Any event, anywhere in the country, plus great seats to Nebraska basketball and the NCAA volleyball tournament coming up. They got tickets to the first and second round games in Lincoln, first and second round games in Omaha, and also the Kansas City game. So, I guess they're matches, aren't they? I should get my volleyball terms.
Matches.
Yes, they are matches.
I believe it is the whole. It's like tennis. It's game set.
It's first game, second. Yeah, you're right. Game
something,
set.
Something like that. I don't know. I guess there's no set.
Is there no set?
Yeah, it's games or yeah, it's
game then match.
Yeah.
All right, I could do that. So for your tickets to everything, go to TicketExpress.com. Husker Hounds, nothing says Big Red like Husker Hounds. And did you see what happened to USA Today today? Scott made the USA Today because he's got out on his, I believe it's his store on 84th Street, by 84th, and he's got a little LED sign out there.
Yeah.
It just said Scott Frost. And so in the USA Today, there's this big sign with Husker Hounds and the digital sign that said Scott Frost on it.
That is awesome.
Scotty is a marketing genius. He's a smart dude.
The guy's a thinker.
But he also sells really cool Big Red t-shirts, Big Red sweatshirts, Big Red hats, Big Red glasses, Big Red mugs, Big Red posters, Big Red helmets, anything you want Big Red.
I've talked about it a bunch. I get my Husker gear from Scott.
There you go. Three locations in the Omaha area or online at huskerhounds.com.
Which he's also one of the few guys who can actually fit me. Because you're big and tall, size.
Yeah, but you're tall anymore. You're no longer big. My son the other day was got out the old Husker photos of like you on the original pipeline photo. Because after you told the story of where the pipeline came from, and that's for another podcast. But he wanted to see what you looked like. He goes, "That's Rob." I go, "Yeah, that's Rob. You're a little larger 20 years ago, 23 years ago than you are right now.
I'm about 65 pounds larger."
I mean, you didn't have a neck back then. You had a crew cut and no neck.
I was pretty thick.
And your arms were like twice as big.
So you're saying I'm skinny.
You're skinny. Well, that's what happens when you stop doing the roids. Did you inject in the butt or the thigh?
You know it's coming.
What? You're coming across the table to kick my ass?
Fuck you.
I'm joking, folks. As Rob has always said, he didn't need steroids. He was a biochemistry major. He knew how to put foods together, right?
Pretty much. Well, unlike most of the current Nebraska football team, I knew where the weight room was.
Ooh, ba-dum-bum.
Just saying.
I mentioned the waiting. Right now, players feel like they're in limbo. They know eventually they're going to have a new coach, but they know the one who recruited them is no longer there. So what's that like as a player? For a little perspective, we bring in former Husker Zach Potter to the Husker Doc Talk podcast. Zach was a junior when Bill Callahan was fired and then played his senior season for Bo Pelini. Hello, Zach. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good. How are you guys doing?
Well, you know, we're sitting here drinking beer, and, you know, we invited you to the studio, but you had to play like – daddy at home or something like that and didn't want to come drink beer with
us. Brought your kids. Like, I would have brought my kids to babysit your kids.
We could have had some babysitters there, I bet. But, yeah, had to play dad duty tonight. Wife's out for a work function, so glad I could make it on the show, though.
Before we dive into what it's like to play for a coach who gets fired and wait for a new one, how many times have you been asked on the street in the last week, hey, is Scott Frost going to be our head coach?
Too many, I should say. I think, you know, you look at it, all the starters alignment, he's probably going to be our coach, but, you know, I'm definitely getting sick of all the Frost winter jokes type of thing. So I'll be excited after the game next Saturday for him that we'll assuming he's going to come home after that, so that'll be good.
It's funny because Dr. Rob was saying before he went in, he goes, I'm sick and tired of people asking me. He goes, you know, it's pretty obvious what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at all the openings out there right now and all the coaching candidates, there's, you know, no one's talking about Frost anymore. Everyone basically knows he's probably coming to Nebraska. You haven't heard any other coaches linked to Nebraska. So let's just kind of cut to the chase and let's get this UCF game over with and let's hire him.
Well, and some of it, I think, is kind of the power of social media in terms of information dissemination. You go back 10, 15, 20 years ago when a lot of the potential for social media, I mean, you had Facebook at least. It existed, but I don't think you saw people using it in terms of spreading information like they do now. Travis, I mean, you had some very good, I guess I'd call it inside insights into what's going on with Scott. It was one of those things where, what was it, a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, you texted me and you basically kind of had sort of like a, dude, it's a done deal. Here's what I heard. Here's who I heard it from. And some of this is stuff you don't put out there publicly.
Well, you can't.
Yeah, I mean, who you heard it from, but you kind of had that information and gave it to me. And there was some kind of some other just sort of procedural things. Here's what's happened. Here's how it happened. Here's how it's going to continue to happen. I'm thinking, oh, my God, it's insane. I'm getting this inside info from Travis, and here's who he's getting it from, and these are incredibly good sources. I go to work the next day. I got people at work like, "Hey, Rob, I heard this. What do you think?" I'm like, "Where the hell did you hear that?" It's like, Twitter,
because
or whatever. But it's just the information's out there, and it's mind blowing to me how well even the quote unquote inside information gets out and gets around. Everybody kind of knows everything now, and there's not a lot of surprise involved anymore with a lot of this.
There are no secrets whatsoever. Zach, when you saw Mike Riley get fired, did that bring back memories from 2007 for you?
No, not at all, because they were so black and white different than how it was handled and how it was, news was released. I mean, I remember, I think I was looking back at Dirk Chatwin from the World Herald's timeline of the Callahan deal, and he pulled into the north side of the Hawk Center. Osborne followed in. 15 minutes later, Callahan pulled out, and it was done. And then all of a sudden, I think we all got an email or a text of, "Hey, team meeting at this time. If you can make it, great. If you can't, we understand." Because we played on that Friday out in Colorado after Thanksgiving, so most people either came back right away and got out of here to go, spend a couple of days with their family before we head back to classes. Or people, me, I think I had already come back to Omaha, but obviously I basically turned around and went back down to Lincoln because I want to be, the most informed as I could, getting ready to, embark on my senior year type of thing. And, it was just, seeing how Bill Moose handled everything from talking to Riley, talking to the assistants, talking to the players, and then just for the sake that and came to the press conference after the fact and kind of quashed all the rumors, which I think is a great thing that he did, especially in this world of social media and Twitter, because how many times would he have gotten a phone call? And I'm sure he's probably gotten still some phone calls after the fact, but that was kind of his let's close the book on this chapter and move on, because, really, what else are you going to reach out to the guy about? I mean, he's as nice as a guy as you could ask for, and, it sounds like he stuck around and shook everyone's hand in the media after the fact, thanked them. Obviously, most of the media people thanked him, too, for, being as open and for how he handled this season and everything. So it's really hard to compare the two of Callahan to Riley besides the fact that we each got blown out on that Friday after Thanksgiving, and our coaches got fired. So.
Well, but there were some similarities in the way, the process, because Steve Peterson was fired in the middle of the season. Sean Eichhorst gets fired in the middle of the season. At what point is a player? Because to me, it looked like, especially second half of the Iowa game, those guys had quit. There had been rumors that there was a little infighting because they all knew it was over.
Well,
it,
and I guess my question, which I think is where Travis is going, at what point did you guys as players, or did you, at least you as a player, have the notion that, okay, this coaching staff's done? Or did you until it happened? I mean, because I guess going back to 07 as a fan, I felt like, okay, Callahan's done the moment Peterson got fired. Same thing with Riley. The moment that Sean Eichhorst got fired, in my mind, Riley's days were numbered.
Yeah, I know. I agree. You know, because especially, you know, Peterson, you know, these ADs, they tied themselves to these football coaches. Moose will be tied to Frost or whoever he ends up hiring, you know, next week. But, you know, Peterson was tied to Callahan. I, of course, was tied to Riley. So, you know, like you said, Rob, as soon as that AD's gone, you know that, you know, naturally there's going to be some type of change, whether it's the head coach completely cleans house and, hey, we're going to keep the head guy, or everyone's going to be gone. I think, you know, in the Callahan year back in 07, you know, we had several losses there toward the end of the season that were pretty bad. And I think at that point you just knew that the whole staff was not going to make it through. I think there's some points in my head that I thought, you know, maybe our defense is just that bad. And, you know, I was a defensive end, and so take full credit for some of how bad we were. But, you know, maybe that, you know, Cosgrove and his assistants are let go. But I don't – our offense really wasn't terrible under Callahan. You know, they did some decent things. I think one of the biggest mistakes that we had that whole season of 07 was the fact that Sam Keller was our quarterback, when a guy like Joe Gans, I think, easily could have led us to some more victories with just his knowledge of the system. And kind of, I think Coach Callahan kind of forced Sam into that starting QB role after coming from Arizona State, when, you know, Joe, you know, sat behind plenty of people, sat behind a guy like Zach Taylor, and then I think easily could have propelled us there. Because as soon as Joe took over there those last couple games in the season, our offense definitely clicked a lot more, I think, as a whole.
You're right, and of course it showed the next year when Joe was the starter. Did the coaching staff at any point during your junior year, did they cash it in, or did they coach the same all the way until they got fired?
No, they coached the same all the way until they got fired. I think that's in the coach's blood. I mean, obviously they get frustrated with the results. You know these guys know. I mean, most of these coaches have been around long enough that, you know, you're going to get fired or let go from a job at some point. I mean, very rarely do you see a coach last in the same role at the same school for, you know, numerous years and type of thing. So I think I remember all my coaches handled it very professionally. We had Buddy Wyatt that junior year there as our D-line coach, was a professional coach, and did some good things with us. But, yeah, he never, threw in the towel and said, hey, you guys watch the film, I'm not going to prepare you. I mean, he always had the game plan ready for us. Cosgrove was the same way. He was, you know, professional about it. And, just one of those things where no matter what we did as a team or as a staff or as players, we just couldn't get the results in the field. And obviously there's a lot of similarities to 07 to this year. You know, not only, like you said, Travis, you know, Eichhorst got fired, Peterson got fired, head coach gets fired, defense wasn't very good, type of thing. So just, it all kind of snowballs and it aligns pretty quickly there. But it's tough to go through it, no doubt.
What making that transition to a new coach, when Pelini came in the next year, was there like a buy-in process? I mean, and I guess what goes through your mind, your mentality, in when that new coach, that new staff comes in, what are your thoughts? I mean, I got to be honest. I mean, I did it at the NFL level 1 year, but other than that, it was just something I never had to really deal with.
Yeah, you know, I think the biggest thing, there's two things that I think that stood out. One being, Pelini was the guy that first was recruiting me back in 03 under Solich. So that was kind of a neat deal, because he was the one that first started reaching out to me when I was at Creighton Prep. He stayed in touch with me in 04 when he went to Oklahoma. And then we kind of lost track when he went to LSU, because I had gotten through the recruiting process far enough that I was going to Nebraska. So, you know, as soon as he came back, that kind of made it full circle. And, hey, Coach, how's it going? Good to see you again. But, you know, I was a rare case because not all these guys had ever met Pelini before, let alone ever talked to him. So a lot of these guys had no idea who he was. But at the same time, you knew, you know, if you'd followed Husker football enough, you knew what he was like back in 03 as a local Nebraska kid. You knew that the buy-in that those players had back in 03, you know, with, you know, I just remember like Bernard Thomas and some of these guys at the Michigan State Alamo Bowl game. I mean, those guys just laid it all on the line for him and really wanted him to take over as coach in 04. But, you know, still, you know, with the fired coach, you mentioned, you know, the NFL. I mean, that happened to me numerous times in the NFL, going from team to team or a different coaching staff. But I think the number one thing, when you know your head coach has been fired, or even your position coach, truthfully, has been fired, I think you first, my first instinct was always, sounds like, that you guys are going to come in and watch. Because you know as soon as the new coaching staff's hired, the first thing they're going to do is throw on the film from the previous year, whether it's practice or a game, and say, you know, are
you
guys
suck.
Any good? You know? I mean, truthfully, I mean, you know, if you're a starter, in 07, so actually I believed in myself enough that I wasn't, you know, the only cause of a bad defense in 07, but, you know, I think naturally I'm thinking, man, I hope my film was out there good enough. And then if you, as a backup player, I think you're thinking, hey, I got a good shot now to maybe overtake that starter because, you know, it's a clean, he's got coaches going to come in with a clean slate. He doesn't know me from anybody else, whatever. If I got along or didn't get along with that previous head coach or a position coach, it doesn't matter. I got to work for this new guy. So I think those are some of the things that pop in your head, at least into my head of, hey, it doesn't really matter what I did in the past. I gotta make sure this spring ball, I, you know, play really hard and put my best foot forward. Just because I started the last, you know, 12 games in my junior year doesn't mean I'm going to start my senior year. So I think those are things that popped in my head initially.
Is there like a buy-in to the program though? And in this, I guess I ask that in the sense that, you know, do you still view yourself as, hey, we're still Nebraska, this is still Nebraska football? Because now, I mean, it's,
yeah,
you kind of have that identity, and oftentimes that gets linked with a coach.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, I think you have the buy-in for the program, for the team, because, I mean, you see it more so, I think, in maybe college basketball because, or really just college athletics as a whole, I guess. But, you know, all these players commit to a coach. They're, you know, they want to say you're committing to the school for the academics, you know, the camp or do these schools for the coach. And so when that coach is gone, I think you don't have a choice. If you're going to stick around at the school, which we didn't lose many transfers, I don't think, after Callahan left. Don't fact check me on that, but I don't remember losing many, real contributors. I'm sure we lost some guys that were younger or lower in the depth chart. But, you know, I still think there's the buy-in of, hey, we got a new staff. We know we weren't real good last year. What can we do to make this next year better? Get off on the right foot. But, you know, I look at it's not always just the players. A lot of times it does come down to the coaching staff. I look at this year, I look at Case Keenum for the Minnesota Vikings and Jared Goff for the LA Rams. Both those guys were at the Rams last year with a different coaching staff, and they both weren't very good. Now they each get a new coaching staff, head coach and an OC in Minnesota and LA, and they're both thriving. So you know, sometimes it's just that coach knowing what buttons to push on that player and what plays the dial up in that situation.
Zach Potter joins us on the Husker Doc Talk podcast presented by the Remington Trophy. I want to go back before Pelini was hired. So in the interim, as Callahan gets fired and then you're in limbo, what is that? Tell me what these players are going through right now. I mean, they got a good idea that it's going to be Scott Frost, but what are these players going through? And when you were going through it, did Tom Osborne communicate with you guys with what he was going to do, his approach, or did you just wait till, hey, Bo Pelini is going to be our head coach?
No, I think there was a couple emails or, you know, there's text messenger was really kind of getting started then. You know, social media wasn't really around, so it's not like you could send out a mass tweet to everybody or, you know, I know Facebook, but, you know, he was in communication, whether it's through a group text or an email to the teams, kind of just updating the process. We knew for a fact, I think, that it was similar to this year, I think. I think a lot of people thought that Sweeney was going to be the guy pretty early on. He was having a lot of success at LSU. They ended up winning a national championship. So I think there was a lot of kind of waiting there that we kind of knew that's where we were going to go, but no real official announcement had been made. And that's kind of how it is this year, where we all are pretty sure it's going to go to Frost, but nothing's been made yet. But, you know, as a player standpoint right now, you hate to say it. I was a junior, a true junior. I had a lot of friends that were redshirt juniors and were part of the team in 04 that didn't go to a bowl game. So you hate to say that some of those guys were that was the second time in 4 years that they weren't going to a bowl game, so they kind of knew what to do. Me having to go to a bowl game my freshman, sophomore year, then junior, just kind of, you know, it's just kind of a weird feeling because you expect to go to a bowl game every year at Nebraska. You expect to, you know, have an extra 3-4 weeks of practice, keep lifting, getting ready for that bowl prep, and then getting ready for that final game and, you know, nice trip to end of the year. You know, Callahan got fired. We came back. He got fired, and we were just kind of in limbo there a little bit. I remember we had some workouts in the weight room, which was just kind of strange because you didn't really know, you know, what was happening, what you were lifting for. You know, obviously just kind of let's get through some of the end of the season soreness and sit and wait, really. But it's just such a weird feeling because you're working with school to finish that up before the holidays. You don't really know who your coach is going to be. There's just so many unknowns that these guys are going through right now, and it's not a good situation to be in.
Did you guys, you know, you mentioned you didn't have as much of the social media, but, I mean, you did have a lot of media in general that's out there and about. I mean, do you think the players now are following what's going on in terms of the information that is available? I mean, do you think that?
How do you not?
I don't know. As a player, do you not want to know in the sense of, hey, we're just going to let this play out? Or, I mean, are you jumping on every lead like the fans are?
I'd say 90% of them are jumping on everything. And the problem with social media these days is obviously it's great because you get tons of access and, you know, your unnamed sources, all this stuff are more than often than not, they're right. But the problem with the media these days, they don't have time to fact check anything. So as soon as they hear it, they're tweeting about it, whether it's right or wrong. They have, you know, all these guys are trying to be the first one to get it out there and say, you know, first reported by X. But I think as a player, as these players are sitting there down in Lincoln right now, finishing the school year, I think, you know, it's hard not to because, you know, just like you said, you know, me and you and Trevor, you know, getting all these questions about, is it going to be Frost? Is it not going to be Frost? I mean, think of all these kids that are walking around campus going into classes every single day. Doctor, I don't know how it was when you were there, but, you know, we had a nice Adidas deal, and, you know, I was a cheap college kid, so I was decked out head to toe in my Nebraska Adidas gear going to class every day. So we kind of stood out like a sore thumb when we went to class. So naturally, you know, people are asking you the same thing. You know, you might pick up the Daily Nebraskan in class because if someone left it there previously, I'm sure they're writing articles on there. You know, classes get boring in December, even though it's sort of the end of the year. You know, these guys are probably on Twitter and all this stuff during the middle of class because they get bored. I mean, you know, naturally, I think, you know, everything that you and I and are seeing, and whether that's right or wrong, they're seeing it. And, you know, maybe it's a good thing that we're so ingrained maybe on Frost because, you know, I don't think it's going to turn this way, but if it would have been a Peterson-Callahan deal where it lasted 45 days, whatever it was, and that gets a little more stressful because you're just sitting there in a complete limbo.
Well,
I think at least right now,
I can't even begin. You know, I forget about
that. We're
pretty
sure it's going to be Frost.
Yeah, I mean, from the plane waiting for Houston Nutt to Cunningham, who was the old Kansas City Chiefs OC that was going to take the job?
Gunther Cunningham?
Gunther, no, and he was the defensive coordinator. He was under Marty Schottenheimer.
Tom Davey?
Who?
Not Bob
Davey?
Not
Bob.
No,
always
no.
Lincoln doing something.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's buying a house. It's funny. The only thing I heard in your answer there is that you're a cheap college kid, which only just told me you are your father's son. That's an inside joke, and just let everybody know that Zach's dad is super cheap. Just one of the cheapest human beings alive.
Okay.
I would say, I'll stick up for my dad and say he's not cheap. He's frugal.
Okay.
Hey, Zach, by the way, that coming from Travis, I mean, that would be like Darth Vader walking up to you and saying, hey, you're an asshole.
Zach, that's great stuff. I think it gives a lot of people a lot of insight. And I know you're busy playing Mr. Dad tonight, but thanks for giving us 20 minutes. It's going to be fun. Hey, we might be in a couple weeks or maybe a week, we might be doing a live recording at the Infusion Brewing in Benson. Maybe you make your way down for that.
That'd be great. Give me enough notice. I'll make my way down there for sure.
All right, Zach. Thanks, buddy. We'll talk to you soon. Pretty good insight from Zach right there.
That is interesting as all heck to me. I mean, the processes that he went through with a coach being fired, a coach getting hired, it's interesting because it's just not something I really experienced. Now, I had a coaching change with the Giants at the NFL level, which Zach went through like a dozen of those at the NFL level because he actually played long enough to get through a dozen of them. I only played long enough to have one. But at the NFL level, it's truly different because it's a job. There's a professionalism in there where it's, well, all right, next coach, let's see what he wants us to do, and we'll I hope I don't get cut. And what's the next week's game plan? I mean, that was it. I mean, it was all very, it was calculated almost to a degree of coldness just in terms of how much a business it was. I can't imagine it at the college level. The one thing I did know is what he was talking about, where he actually initially got recruited back in high school by Pelini in 03.
Well, it's interesting because I remember we were at the St. Pius St. Leo sports banquet. Bo came and spoke. I think Zach was a junior at that point. He was sitting at my table. I was with his dad, Zach, Bob Carlisle, who's now my boss, and Bo actually came up and started recruiting him right there. We started laughing. And that might have been it had to be his junior year. So it was I was there when that process started, should we
very
say.
Very nice.
Yes.
But yeah, it's little things like that. I've got very little insight into the concept of the coaching change because I was playing at Nebraska when, you know, one of the big recruiting points at Nebraska was the stability of the coaching staff. You had all of these guys who had been there forever. Literally 50 assistants who'd been there for 15 plus years. That's something that's pretty unheard of in this day and age.
All right, time now for the favorite segment of this Husker Doc Talk podcast. That is listener email. Are you ready, Doc?
Let's do it.
Thomas asks, there's been a lot of talk about this team having talent. Other than maybe the kicker and the punter, is there even one all-conference player on the team? Though there's two honorable mentions.
well, officially, as of today, no.
Nebraska used to litter the all-conference All-American teams. That has dwindled to non-existence. Now, keep in mind, winning and losing plays a lot into doing with that.
I actually thought Drew Brown, at worst, I thought he should have been second.
I get that, but you know when you suck royally, you don't get much love.
It affects things. It really does. I thought Drew was at worst second team all Big Ten kicker, at least on his freaking tackling ability, hit harder than most of the guys on the kickoff team.
Nick wants to know, with it seeming imminent, that Frost is going to be coming back to Nebraska. Do you believe he will be able to recruit the state of Florida with the same success he did at UCF?
No, Florida kids don't want to come to Nebraska. I say that as a, sorry, cold hard fact kind of manner, but no, it won't be as easy. It's easier to get Florida kids to go to Central Florida, South Florida, and even, I call it the mid-major up-and-comers like Florida Atlantic and FIU. It's easier to get Florida kids to go to those schools than it probably would Nebraska. Now, is he going to recruit Florida better than, say, oh, I don't know, Mike Riley? Yes. I think he does. I think he's made some incredible inroads there in a very, very short period of time, and I think he'll maintain those. I always go back to the thing on recruiting. I'm going to tangent here for just a second, but you got to have recruiting. You got to have excellent recruiting. You got to bring in a lot of talent. Keep in mind, if recruiting was an end-all, be-all, why isn't Florida in the top five every year? Why isn't Miami in the top five every year? Why isn't Florida State winning a national title every year? Why isn't Texas and Texas A&M, why aren't those top five teams every year? Why aren't USC and UCLA top teams every single year? If recruiting was as important as I think sometimes it's made out to be, then you'd see those schools just essentially completely ruling the top 10 year in and year out. And they're not, because there's a lot of other things that factor into it. Do you want the good recruits from Florida? Yes, you do. Is Nebraska going to be able to get them more easily with Scott Frost? Yes, I do think that.
Jacob has a conspiracy theory. In 1971, Nebraska won the national title over Alabama. Mike Riley played for that Alabama team, and since 71, he planned his revenge. He made it his goal to destroy Nebraska football, which he did from the inside out as head coach. Your thoughts?
I'm just going to keep drinking beer and not even answer that.
Bob wants to know, what types of offenses and defenses do you think head coach Scott Frost runs if he comes to Nebraska? 3-4-D, 4-3, spread offense, or zone read?
I think he runs a 4-3 defense, and I think on offense he runs kind of a combination of the spread and the zone read. It's not as hard to bounce between the two as one might think.
Hey, I'm going to take a break from questions right now because I got into a pissing match on Twitter.
What?
This week with an Omaha television personality who's not originally from here. He transplanted here about 3-4 years ago, and he used to do sports.
I missed this. What Twitter account were you on?
He tweeted on Saturday that Gus Malzahn is the most innovative football coach, offensive football coach of his lifetime. And I said, Tom Osborne wasn't too bad. And he said, besides Georgia Tech, who runs that type of offense today?
Okay.
And I said, hold on for a second. I said, what Georgia Tech runs and what Nebraska run, especially from 93 up until whenever, is not that type of option offense. In fact, I could make the argument that Tom Osborne in 95, maybe even 94, started what we see now as the spread offense. The only difference was...
We've talked about this before. I thought Osborne ran the spread option when I was... it probably was 92, 93. You had Tommy Frazier, Brooke Behringer, and all of a sudden Osborne was like, how about we back these guys up into the shotgun and run the entire running offense out of shotgun?
But even Tommy and Brooke went under center at some times.
They did. He moved... Osborne was very fluid in what he did. I mean, we had a lot of option running plays. We had a lot of play action pass. We had a lot of power running plays. We ran a lot. Everybody keeps bagging on the zone blocking schemes. From 91 onward, the zone blocking scheme for our bread and butter running plays, that's what we did.
It was
a zone blocking scheme.
I thought Tom was a genius, and the only difference is, sure, you know, Gus Malzahn can run the little pop pass, but at the end of the day, especially the great Nebraska teams, didn't have to run gimmick plays to win.
No, we didn't. Well, and part of the reason that I think it made Osborne so hard to defend against, I mean, as an offensive coach, was the fact that he moved so fluidly from system to system. Now, was it predicated on a running offense? Yeah, well, there's... many, many styles of running offense. It's like saying there's only one passing offense in existence. No, there's not. I mean, there's the West Coast. There's kind of a spread passing system. You can run a pro style passing system. You can run a run and shoot. I mean, you can run Don Coryell, which is kind of sort of a Mike Leach air raid system.
His point to me was, what major Power 5 conference is running what Nebraska did in the 90s? And I said, about everybody. I said,
that's kind of what's happened. And I think because people look back at Nebraska and they want to say, hey, they were either an option offense or a power running offense. And I'm like, God, I have trouble when I think back about what we ran. I have trouble pinning on any one thing because it's one. You'd run a couple of ISO plays, which is about as old school Woody Hayes, 3 yards in a cloud of dust as you can get. Then we'd throw in a couple of options. Then we'd throw in a trap. Then we'd throw in some zone blocking running plays. Then we'd run some Joe Gibbs, which is actually based off – Joe based a lot of his offense off of what Vince Lombardi did with the Packers back in the 1960s with the pulling guards, pulling tackles. It's – God, I can't put my finger on what Osborne ran. Everybody look, Osborne did not run a classic triple option,
which makes
Oklahoma did.
Yes, that's why.
But Oklahoma was one of the very few who did it.
But see, Osborne was so innovative that he made the dual threat quarterback what it is today. Nobody knew what a dual threat quarterback was in the early 90s.
No, and I totally agree with you. I disagree with this guy's assessment. Yeah, that's part of the reason. I think there's two reasons why Paul Johnson's had some trouble kind of getting out of the middle of the road of the ACC. I mean, he kind of hangs out in the middle of the pack in the ACC year in and year out. And it's because he runs kind of a singular triple option offense.
And when you can't pass, you can't.
Yeah, he doesn't have a lot of variety. And that defenses can kind of, you prep for the option when you play Georgia Tech, and if you completely shut down the option, you're probably going to win that game. Paul Johnson's never been known for defense either. And that's something that's hurt him. Osborne put a lot of emphasis on what Charlie McBride did. Barry Switzer put a lot of emphasis on what Gary Gibbs did as his defensive coordinator. You got to be able to play a little bit of defense. And I keep hearing a lot of people saying, man, if we don't get Scott, we should get Paul Johnson up here. I'm like, man, I don't know. I love the option offense. It's fun to watch, but God, you got to have a little fluidity there between some different styles, and you got to play defense.
It's funny you just mentioned that because Jason wants to talk about Plan B. Would Brett Bielema be a good fit at Nebraska? Since David Shaw would probably never leave Stanford, a second choice if Moose is unable to lure Frost away from UCF.
God, well, I love Shaw.
Let me answer your question, and I'm an Iowa guy. Brett did a lot when he played at the University of Iowa. But let's be honest, he's a failure at Arkansas. And he only succeeded at Wisconsin because Barry Alvarez is still there to pull the puppet strings. Gary Anderson failed at Oregon State after he left Wisconsin.
Well, he did. Now,
I'm not a Brett Bielema fan.
I think Gary Anderson's success at Wisconsin was due partly to the players he had, partly due to the fact that he did have Alvarez kind of saying, here's the offense you're going to run. And here's the defense you're going to run. And I think Gary Anderson did it at Wisconsin. And as soon as he left Wisconsin and quit doing what Barry wanted with Barry and Brett's players, he fell flat on his face. Here's the other thing about Bielema in terms of why I think he was good at Wisconsin. I still think it was the Dan Hawkins, Chris Peterson effect. I think a lot of Bielema's success at Wisconsin was due to Paul Christ as his offensive coordinator. I think Christ is an outstanding, outstanding coach. And I think he's underrated because he runs a style and a system up there.
It's boring.
It's kind of boring. I watched that. I watched the Iowa-Wisconsin game, and I'm not saying this because I hate Iowa and I want to make Travis feel bad, but...
Yes, you do.
Yeah, I do. I really do. But that Iowa-Wisconsin game was like watching... It was like watching a heavyweight boxing match, and the guy that was going to win it did nothing but stand there and throw body blow after body blow the whole boxing match. And it doesn't look like when you're a boxer and you're doing that, it doesn't look like you're doing anything. It looks like you're standing there playing defense. But I mean, at halftime of that Wisconsin game, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was a 10-7 Iowa lead.
Mm.
Or was it 10-10?
I'm trying to remember.
It was 10-7 or 10-10. It was either 10-7.
Iowa wasn't up at half.
Then it was tied, I think, 10-10 at half. Or Iowa took the lead shortly after halftime. Iowa basically.
No, Iowa never led in the second half.
Okay, so it was either Iowa was ahead at halftime or the score was tied. It was a very close game. And actually, I thought Iowa had the momentum at least going into halftime.
But they weren't moving the ball. I mean, that was the thing. I mean,
and that's true. And that's the thing. It was kind of a boring football game, and it didn't look like Wisconsin was really doing anything either. And that's kind of the key point here that I'm trying to make. It's just that all of a sudden, the game was over, and Wisconsin somehow was ahead 24-10.
So it was 17-7 Wisconsin at halftime.
Okay, so Wisconsin had the lead. Second quarter, it was a close game. I think Wisconsin.
I was up 7-3 after the first quarter.
That's what I'm. Okay. Yep. I've been drinking too much beer.
It's fine. It's
okay.
Fine.
Beer. Sorry. Anyway, my point is Wisconsin went out. It was the most mundane game you've ever watched in your life. And I watched it start to finish. And it was boring. It was unexciting. I know it's kind of redundant, I guess. But you're kind of watching it, and it wasn't like you sat there thinking, God, Wisconsin's blowing these guys out. And then all of a sudden, it's what was the final, 24-7?
38-14.
Okay, 38-14. So Wisconsin smoked them.
Yes.
By the end of the game, Wisconsin had smoked them.
Well, Iowa only had
66 yards rushing.
Yeah, they had 25 yards rushing, 51 yards passing, 41 yards passing. I mean, 66 yards of total offense isn't going to get it done.
God, that's horrible, Travis.
So
I think even Nebraska had better yardage against Iowa.
Oh, they did.
That.
Hey,
but anyway, my
thanks
point
for pointing
is,
that out.
Yeah, my point is just that Wisconsin. God, it seems boring and mundane, but God, they just destroy people with it. I'll be curious to see how they do against Ohio State in the Big Ten title game. I haven't bought into Bielema. I've seen a lot of people saying, well, his lack of success at Arkansas was due to the fact that that system, his Wisconsin system, didn't cut it in the SEC. And I'm calling bullshit on that. I say Alabama and Auburn and some of these other teams that occasionally do very well in the SEC are running a run-heavy pro-style offense that works great in the Big Ten, and that's what Barry's implemented and had all his people up at Wisconsin running for the last 30 years.
So it looks like Tim wants a quick turnaround. With the talent level on the team being relatively high, is it? How much of a turnaround could be reasonably expected in 1 year, especially given the schedule next year?
Boy, I'd have to look at the schedule right in front of me. That's a tough one. Schedule next year I know is going to be a lot tougher than it has been the last couple years. I do think there's a fair amount of talent in Lincoln. Actually, I think there's quite a bit of talent in Lincoln. I think it's been ungodly undercoached. I also think it's been, and this was probably the bigger thing, underdeveloped. And what I mean by that is when you look at both the physical and mental development of these players, I think it has seriously suffered over the last few years.
So here's your schedule. Akron at home, Colorado at home. Troy.
Should be a win, should be a win.
Troy.
Should be a win.
At Michigan. Purdue.
Well, hold on. I'm thinking about Michigan.
If they get a quarterback, they're going to be okay, but they need a quarterback.
Nebraska or Michigan?
Both.
Yeah. I think Nebraska, if Nebraska can keep Lee or develop O'Brien or Jebbia, God, there's a lot of people who are saying Tristan Jebbia was maybe better than Tanner Lee.
Then you got.
I think they can match up against Michigan. I think Michigan's defense is insanely good and is going to continue to be insanely good. That's going to be a tough one. Purdue after that should beat Purdue.
Wisconsin.
They beat Purdue this year.
Yeah. Then you got at Wisconsin.
Loss.
At Northwestern.
Wild card. You
Minnesota
know,
at home.
Pelini had some fairly good success against Northwestern.
Pelini's not here anymore.
I know. I'm just saying. My point is I think the talent level, I'm not talking about coaching, I think the talent level most years, year in and year out, is above and beyond what Northwestern has. This year's loss to Northwestern, I think, falls squarely on the shoulders of coaching.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, the schedule's a bitch. You got Colorado, Michigan, Wisconsin, Northwestern, Ohio State, Michigan State, and Iowa. I mean, that's nasty.
That's
not fair to a lot of teams, especially when Iowa gets a super easy schedule next year.
Okay, fair has nothing to do with it. Nebraska had, honestly, Nebraska had an easy schedule this year, and talk about stinking it up. Yeah. Good Lord.
So Jared brings up a couple good points. Much of our attention is on Frost or whomever will be the next head coach, but looking forward, what are the two position, one or two positions in greatest need, whether that's talent or a need of different coaching?
O-line.
You were disappointed with the O-line all year.
Oh God, it was horrible. I didn't make any bones about that. And I think, again, player development. God, I wish those guys would find out where the weight room's at. I don't know what they're doing for workouts, but they're obviously not doing them. So I would love to see a lot more. And that, you know, that maybe that's a good second half answer to this question you asked for two position groups. You know, if you want to maybe not call it a position group, but an area of coaching, one, O-line, both talent and coaching, and two, strength and conditioning. Now, they talked about how there was a big uptick in strength and conditioning. Great. I want to know who was showing up for that, because it obviously wasn't a lot of the guys on this team.
Dave says, hey, Dr. Rob, enjoyed chatting with you in the stands at the Iowa game.
Very cool. Sat next to Dave. He and sat next to my daughter and I. It was actually very nice.
Did you tell him you did a podcast, or did he know you did a podcast?
He brought up the podcast. He sat down. He's like, hey, I listened to your podcast.
Here's my question.
This is from, very nice couple, by the way.
This is from Dave. Bob Diaco is now several years removed from his strongest entry in his coaching resume, his stint as the defensive coordinator at Notre Dame. Since then, he's had a failed head coaching gig at UConn, an even more disastrous year as a defensive coordinator at Nebraska. How big of a hit does he take from this? Where does he go from here? To use a stock market analogy, is he a solid stock that is now way undervalued due to recent peak performance, or is he a stock that has been exposed as wildly overvalued?
I think overvalued. I think this is a guy who... You know, you kind of hit the nail on the head, I think, when you and I talked about this off the podcast, that in some of his prior coaching gigs, he'd almost been kind of, to a degree, held in check by sort of like strong personality head coaches. I mean, a guy like Brian Kelly was somebody who kind of kept Diaco in check a little bit just by force or strength of personality. I think he's overvalued. I think he's a guy who maybe has this incredibly strong knowledge of the game, of defensive play, but has a complete inability to translate that as a coach to the players that he's supposed to be coaching. I think as a head coach and an offensive coordinator, I think Callahan was the same way. If you kind of bring it down to the level of an offensive line coach, he's potentially one of the best ever. But you go beyond that, and the guy's an utter failure. And I think Diaco's in the same boat. I think he operates just on an intellectual level that does not translate to the art of actually coaching.
Now, I will say this, because coaching is a small fraternity. Bob Diaco will work again. He'll probably be either a head coach or a defensive coordinator again.
Agree.
But will he get exposed again? Probably. He went in with huge, lofty expectations. I mean, they were built up by a lot of different people. I would have liked to see – no, I wouldn't. I'm glad this whole thing is over. But what have you made a difference over a number of years? We'll never know that, right? I mean
– I don't think so.
Okay.
And I think it's because of – like I said, I think it's because of – you look at a new D coordinator, you look at a new coordinator – You know, I talked about this before. Pelini showed up in 2003, and it was an immediate improvement. Brand new system. It wasn't like, okay, no, we need years to implement this. No. Pelini upgraded things day one. When Kevin Cosgrove arrived on campus, sadly, Nebraska didn't become as epically bad as they were this year, even, and that was with Cosgrove.
That's true.
When Charlie McBride retired after, what was it, the 99 season.
Which they should have won the national title.
Should have. And Craig Bohl got elevated to D coordinator from the linebackers coaching spot. You know, he was not a great D coordinator.
Good head coach.
excellent head coach, not a good D coordinator. Mm-hmm. Nebraska was not as epically bad as they were this year. When Bo Pelini came back, and it was Bo and Carl, and what was that, in 2008, Nebraska had an immediate upgrade. They got better very quickly. So Diaco comes in. If it was a case of, hey, I just, you know what, I've got the system, the system's good. I've also got the ability to coach. I've got the ability to teach players. I've got the ability to get people to understand what I want them to do. At the very least, you should have maybe seen a little bit of a drop-off in defensive play. I mean, they went from – they weren't great under Mark Banker.
They got worse under Diaco.
They weren't epically horrible either under Mark Banker. It was just a freaking disaster this year under Diaco. They couldn't stop anybody except Rutgers and Illinois.
So what's next? Well, we will return to the studio after Scott Frost is officially hired. I want to work out with Danielle at Infusion Brewing, so we might have a live recording in Benson. So keep your eyes on Twitter for that. Keep your eyes on Facebook. Follow Infusion Brewing on Twitter and Facebook, and we'll see if we can get a live recording at the Infusion Brewing Company in Benson. No guarantees, but we're going to try to make it happen, make it a fun night, maybe a Tuesday night or a Wednesday night, get together, drink some beer, talk some football, and have some good fun. But we'd love as many as people as possible to show up and ask questions and drink beer. So it's that simple, guys. We can make it work that easily. Make sure to follow Dr. Rob on Twitter at DocTalkSports. You can always send us questions, by the way. Email DocTalkSports@gmail.com. Please take a moment to rate this podcast and give it a review on iTunes or whatever service you are listening to the podcast on. Huge thank to Husker Max for distributing the podcast. Husker Max, when you need your Husker fix 24/7, 365. For Dr. Rob Zadisk, I'm Travis Justice. Thanks for listening to the Husker Doc Talk podcast presented by the Remington Trophy.